We've had a number of discussions the past weeks on relating things like the gap between the people who have a lot and those who we say are the have-nots. We've talked about the need for a global view of things, a world view in relation to energy, for example, and resources. Those of you who heard Rudy this morning. We've talked about our own consumer lifestyles in the United States. And we try to put it in the perspective of God so loved the world that we can't just think about ourselves. We need to have a global view. Certainly in the last few years, Christian consciousness has been raised about world hunger. You can hardly have been associated with any kind of a church without having heard something about world hunger. And surely there has been a great response from people who care and who want to show that they care. But all of us also realize that sending food is just, well, it's just like putting a Band-Aid on a major wound. And it's just sort of a stopgap measure that we will do that, we must do that, or send resources for food. But that doesn't really get to the basic problem. And so the question as it has been phrased, which I think Tom is responsible for, is there hope for the poor? And is there any hope at all? There certainly is a need for understanding what's going on in the rest of the world insofar as we are able, so we do not misjudge what's happening there. I think it also is important for our own attitudes here, because if we are Christian citizens who are supposed to help influence the policy of our government, then we as Christian citizens have a stake in seeing that our government acts responsibly in terms of the global situation and not just what we think is best for us. I recall a discussion in my own congregation on world hunger, which we surfaced, and a person who was, I think, quite typical, and a person who's supposedly be well-informed, said, now, if those people just wouldn't have so many children, we wouldn't have any problem. This happened to be even an MD, I'm sorry to say. Well, now that's in a typical Lutheran congregation from a person with a better than average congregation. Tonight's discussion is to be some consciousness raising. Some of you don't need that. Some of you are so far ahead, you're with it. I do not claim to be any kind of authority on this subject at all. I'm Evelyn Strang. I teach geography at Texas Lutheran College and some other things. And certainly in my own discipline, and I'm very interdisciplinary, I'm not a specialist, but this theme of global consciousness is one of the things I try to emphasize. I feel it's very, very important. Certainly my own experiences in traveling to different parts of the world are limited. I do live only a little bit over 300 kilometers from the Third World, or from Mexico, from Latin America. And I realized that things going on, you know, just across the Rio Grande there, like this spring, got a lot of people very excited. When there was an uprising in Sinaloa, the state on the west coast of Mexico, where some peasants took over some land. A lot of people got pretty excited. Hey, you know, these property owners are losing their property. What are these commies coming in here and taking over property? That's precisely the kind of thing that we need to understand. There's the whole world out there. Maybe we'll limit it a little bit more to South America, but not necessarily. Dr. Frederick Norstad, otherwise known as Fritz, has a much more authentic insight into the Third World in depth, and he will certainly have some of his own experiences to share in much more depth than I would have as a tourist. There are a number of people in this group tonight who have spent some time living in Third World situations who are also resource people, who I hope will be willing to share their insight. May I go on with just a little bit more background? This is ABC, but maybe we need to review some of this. The division of the world into developed countries or underdeveloped countries or developing countries makes either three worlds, some people make four worlds, some people say there are five worlds, and it depends on whose category you use. But usually those categories are on the basis of economic criteria, like GNP, population growth. One thing, it's always higher percentage increase in the underdeveloped countries, whatever that means, than in the, quote, developed countries. We We have economic indices like industry, the amount of steel used for energy, capita use, and things like that. I think the first point to recognize is that the way most of us are dividing the world according to economic criteria sort of overlooks the fact that these do not necessarily define the quality of life in human terms. I think that's one thing to recognize, that when we define everything in economic terms, there's more to life than these economic factors. And I think another very important thing for understanding is that the historical background for knowing what's going on in the rest of the world is sorely lacking from most of us. Now, I'm speaking about myself. My own background in formal schooling, let's say in the history of the Far East, or the history of Africa, or the history of South America, Latin America, was very, very limited. How was yours? Did you learn a lot about the history of the rest of the world?
No.
Maybe you had some little course someplace in world history. So what I'm saying is that it's very easy for us in this country to make judgments about other countries without having to begin to understand the background from which they come. For example, in our country, the idea that people could come over and do their own thing and develop their farms and homestead and whatever is simply not the development of our neighbors to the south. Certainly the history of Latin America is an entirely different thing in land ownership and use. Latin America and also Africa and other parts of the world were developed as raw material centers for the countries which took them over. In other words, people there never really could do their own thing after the conquistadors or whoever it was came over. In Latin America, it was various land systems. The hacienda system, for example, were a few rich landowners who had some power and had the right connections. Maybe they weren't rich first, but they were lucky they got in with the right people, had the large estates. Or it was a plantation system, again, where production in these plantations, fazendas, whatever, was not for the people there, but was for the countries in the middle latitudes, which liked the tropical products that they couldn't raise in Europe. So the whole economic system developed differently. In North America, we managed to kill off quite a few of our Indians. In Latin America, there are many, many more of the people, the indigenous people, still in the general population. In some of the countries, in the countries of the Altiplano, for example, the majority of the people are, you might say, the direct descendants of those who were there when the conquistadors came over. So that the social structures that developed there, because of historical reasons, are different. That there has been an upper class that had the money, that had the wealth, the status, and the bulk of the land, while the masses of the people, the poor peasants, did not have very much. That the middle class, with which most of us identify in this country, simply was not there to any extent. It's developing now to some extent. So I think this kind of thing is very important for perspective on poverty in countries where it is very, 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 very poignant. It's very easy to ignore some of these issues from the Christian approach. In Latin America, the Roman Catholic Church was often identified with the rich and the powerful. Earlier in Mexico, one of the largest landowners was the Roman Catholic Church. They had a couple of little revolutions there which divested the church of some of the riches, and changes have taken place there. But very often the church has been aligned with the rich and the powerful. I have to think of the example of the Soviet Union and the little I've seen in the Soviet Union. Again, it really hit me that it just, when you see the churches and the wealth and you see the palaces of the czars, you know about that alignment, you begin to understand what happened in the Soviet Union. The other groups in Latin America specifically were rather a minority. I think the Protestants who've come in have often been the isolated immigrant groups. I just had a letter from my son, who's in Argentina now, who just last week, I guess 10 days ago, however long it takes letters to get to Holden, was out in a rural area in a German community where he says, "Mother, it's like it must have been in Texas 30 years ago. It's these people are just not in the mainstream of society." So the immigrant people, who are still horse and buggy people, are there to themselves. But meanwhile, the masses of the people are untouched by regular Protestantism, The Pentecostal groups are working with Native people, but very often they're very fundamentalist. They're concerned mainly with preaching the gospel, which after all is what they're for, but not with the social and political action. All right, out of this situation, the widening gap between the rich and the poor, the desperate plight of the poor, there are voices in the church, the Roman Catholic Church, but also from Protestants, various groups, that are beginning to speak to the need for social and political change. And if you say, is there hope for the poor? There are those now in liberation theology who say the hope for the poor in the application of the gospel. Now, I'm not a theologian, and any theologians here, forgive me. I'm going at this as an amateur, but you know, that's what has to be enough people who are amateurs get excited about it. One of the really important books in this, it's in the bookstore here, A Theology of Liberation. It's translated from the Spanish, Gustavo Gutierrez, out of Peru. This has really been one of the leading books that's made some points. May I just quote Gutierrez a little bit to illustrate this, what it's all about. This is controversial. Some of you may say right now, that sounds like it's communist. But listen, at least, just what Gutierrez says. Gutierrez, they're talking about development, says the poor countries are becoming ever more clearly aware that their underdevelopment is only the byproduct of the development of other countries because of the kind of relationship which exists between the rich and the poor countries. Moreover, they're realizing that their own development will come about only with a struggle to break the domination of the rich countries. Development must attack the root causes of the problems, and among them, the deepest is economic, social, political, and cultural dependence of some countries upon others, an expression of the domination of some social classes over others. Only a radical break from the status quo, that is, a profound transformation of the private property system, access to power of the exploited class, and a social revolution that would break this dependence would allow for the change to a new society. And you say, wow, you see that red flag. But listen a bit more. Gutierrez and others are saying that the theme of liberation is a product of a profound historical movement. This aspiration to liberation is being accepted, beginning to be accepted by the Christian community as a sign of the times, as a call to commitment and interpretation. The biblical message, which presents the work of Christ as a liberation, provides a framework for this interpretation. Theology seems to have avoided for a long time reflecting on the conflictual character of human history, the confrontations among men, social classes, and countries. Still quoting Gutierrez, he's quoting Galatians. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Paul refers to liberation from sin insofar as it represents a selfish turning in upon oneself. To sin is to refuse to love one's neighbor and therefore the Lord himself. Sin, a breach of friendship with God and others, is, according to the Bible, the ultimate cause of poverty, injustice, and the oppression in which men live. It does emphasize the fact that things do not happen by chance, and that behind an unjust structure there is a personal or collective will responsible. Gutierrez asks, free for what? Free to love. Fullness of liberation, a free gift from Christ, is communion with God and with other men. So liberation theology in Latin America sees hope for the poor and applying the gospel to social and political change. They see in the Old Testament, for example, in the Exodus, a liberation of oppressed peoples. They feel that there is a need to attack deep causes of poverty, that radical change is called for, and that you can't simply put band-aids on the old system. To support the social revolution means to abolish the present status quo and to attempt to replace it with a qualitatively different one. It means to build a just society based on new relationships of production It means to attempt to put an end to the domination of some countries by others, of some social classes by others, of some people by others. The liberation of these countries, social classes, and people undermines the very foundation of the present order. It is the greatest challenge of our time. And one more statement from Gutierrez, and then I'll leave that. Under these circumstances like this, in the kind of world where there is this kind of gap between the rich and the poor, can it honestly be said that the church does not interfere in the temporal sphere, or should not? Is the church fulfilling a purely religious role when by its silence or friendly relationships it ends legitimacy to a dictatorial and oppressive government? Why do you suppose there are even Methodist preachers, aside from some of the Roman Catholics, and Lutheran bishops, like in Chile and others, who find it dangerous to stay in their own country? They are speaking out, in, as they see it, in the name of Christ, the Liberator, for social and political justice, against what they call the oppressive systems which are responsible for much of the poverty. So one answer to is there hope for the poor, as seen by some theologians, is a change in social and political systems in the spirit of Christ.
Fritz? Yeah, where to begin? My contribution to this will have to be rather anecdotal, I think, and maybe that's where I could make the best contribution, just by way of getting a discussion started. Let me tell you about one of the first times I became concerned about the poor. It didn't come easy for me. I guess I didn't tune in very fast on the agony of it all. But the message was so inescapable one day in Recife, Brazil, in 1945. I happened to be on a United States cruiser at the time. The war was over, and we were having a great time on a goodwill tour down through the South Atlantic. We were the 20th Fleet. We were all of the 20th Fleet. There was no more to the fleet than our ship. And so when we came into Bermuda, we were entertained for 2 weeks, and lavishly. And I didn't see the poverty there, but I sure saw a lot of luxury. But we never got off on the side streets. And then we went to Trinidad, and it was pretty much the same thing. And after a few more, one or two week goodwill stops, we ended up in, or came to Recife, Brazil, up on the bulge of Brazil. And there, about the second or third day, we were invited to a big shindig out at somebody's estate, I suppose the wealthiest people in the community. I hope they were. And we came up in a lot of big, black, shiny cars to a large estate, and the gates opened, and the cars went through. And when we got inside, we saw some big tents, or awning-type things, covering tables. And I suspect that maybe there were 500 people there, maybe 80 of us were officers from our ship, and the rest were Brazilians. And the food there would have fed the 5,000 somewhat adequately, I think, but certainly was too much for what, and it was a display. Mountains of meat, whole animals roasted and on tables, and one tent has covered the fruit, beautiful, fantastic. And I got sick looking at it, kind of, because it just somehow or another, even for me, was somewhat repulsive. And so I asked rather early in the game to be excused to turn around and go home again, back to the ship. When we came to the gate, going out, the guards pointed to a large crowd of people who were standing just outside the gate. They'd been standing there looking through at this display on the inside. These were the poor. and I doubt if they felt there was any hope. But the guards were maybe 15 or 20 in number, and the guards had submachine guns. I think they had come probably after the poor had started to assemble and to put down any trouble that might arise out of this. Well, they finally decided that they'd open the gates, and the machine guns were prodding at the people and pushing them back, and finally a path was cleared. And I happened to be sitting in the front seat of a limousine, and the signal was made to come through. But lying dead ahead of us, right on the road, was a man, apparently unconscious, and we didn't know from that distance whether he was alive or dead. And the guards waved us to go through. And I, like I think any of us would have done, simply shouted at the driver not to move after he started to take the foot off the brake. And as we passed through the gate and approached this body 10 feet ahead of us, I couldn't quite take it anymore and jumped out of the car against the protests of the driver and an escort we had with us and the guards who kept on telling us to go forward. And I walked up and called to some of the people to help lift this poor man off the middle of the road. At that point, I hadn't quite realized that there was danger. It was just like, well, an American is not prepared for this kind of thing, I think. All I could see was a car might run over a man who was in the middle of the road, and we better stop and help him. And when I got down to try to help move him, I was joined by 10, 12 other people who helped rather tenderly to take him off the side of the road and put him there. And the crowd was quiet, and we moved on. And then I started to just shiver and shake, and not far down the road lost whatever food I had, simply out of sheer fright, when I realized a little bit later on that it was maybe the safest situation in the world. But the point of the story came the next morning, when I was informed down in my cabin on the ship that there was a Catholic priest who was on the quarterdeck and asked to see me. And so I asked that he be brought down to the wardroom, or the dining room. And a sailor brought him down, and he was a rather shabbily dressed man, not very impressive from any point of view. And he didn't speak much of any English, and I spoke absolutely no Portuguese. But we managed to tell each other that we liked each other and that we were Christians and expressed some kind of love. And there was a kind of a hold and hugging that went on that must have embarrassed him a little bit. But somehow or other, we tried to, by touch at least, to convey something we couldn't in language. And then he kept saying something about thank you. And then I escorted him back up towards the ladder to take him off the ship again. And just as he was leaving, he turned to me and looked at me with eyes that I'll never forget, and said, "I was at the gate yesterday." This man today is leading a revolutionary movement in Brazil. He is a socialist, perhaps communist, I don't know. He is one of those that I would say represents some distant promise, at least, of hope for the poor. I respect him very highly. He lit something, I think, inside of me that I shall always be happy and or thankful for, though it has not contributed to my comfort in living. Another person Mireia Baltadano, who lived with us last year in our home in a lovely suburb of Chicago. She's from Costa Rica, a university student, has taken her 7 years, and she's not quite a senior this year because she has to work. She has no money with which to go to school. She did take some time off on a little scholarship we gave her to give her some training up at Lutheran General Hospital that she wanted very much to get. But she is part of a revolutionary movement in Costa Rica and a part of a growing group of young Christians who have left the Catholic Church, many of them. Many of them are out of the old Latin American mission churches down there, and they have left them. They would be embarrassed, I think, to get caught walking into a church on Sunday morning, because it would be defeating of something that they think they stand for and are trying to tell poor people. But Mireia, who is a brilliant girl, each Sunday morning goes with about 30 or 40 Christian university students down into the barrios, into the worst of the slum areas, and there sits down with just a few girls. Mireia is trying to train secretaries. Now, to train secretaries is very important to her, because she can't find any other way that these girls have any hope of getting out of the barrio than that they can find a way to make a living. Any of you who have been in San Jose, Costa Rica, know that the streets swarm at night. You can't walk five blocks downtown San Jose after, say, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night without seeing 6, 8, 10, 12 girls from 12 to 16 years old on every street corner. And they're having kind of a ball. They're like kids. At a place called Aguantafilo, just let me detour for a moment, a little town, there was a shack with a bunch of packing cases and barrels and things that people were living in. When some of us first saw it, we got some people at the university and some professional groups and some church people together and gave them a few ideas of how they might be able to mobilize some things. Things that come easy for Americans, or ways of thinking that come easy for Americans, and a little bit harder for some of their people. And in Aguantafilo, I stood one day in this little town. Aguantafilo means hold your hunger. How's that for the name of a town? It was given to them by a politician who was making a speech from the bed of a flatbed truck, and he was saying that if you will vote for me, I'll see to it that your children get good education, because there were no schools in this little shack town. And the women, the mothers, cried out and said, we can't wait, give us food today. And the man went on speaking and said, if you vote for me, I'll see to it that, you know, you get jobs and you get food. And they said, but our children are hungry today. Can you give us food today? And they went on down, and each promise that he was making to them, campaign kind of promise, the women shouted out, you know, we're hungry, give us food today. And finally, he couldn't stand the heckling anymore, and so he said, Aguantafilo, which means hold your hunger, and drove off. And some of the people decided that wouldn't make a bad name for the little town. If you ever get down to San Jose, take a look at Aguantafilo today. A bunch of people did get concerned down there. They rebuilt the place, and now there's a little town of 1,000 people. Not a shack in it. Everybody has running water and a flush toilet and shower baths and a light bulb, and the government and the church and the medical school and the school of architecture and the engineers out at the university and a whole bunch of other people all just put their brains together and made a village out of it. That it's like a miracle. Now, when I stood first in Aguantafilo, I noticed around 5:30 in the evening that there were a lot of mothers and girls walking towards the edge of this shack town. And I asked what was going on. And the man My friend, who was taking me through the place, shook his head very sadly and said, well, it's time for the prostitutes to go to work. And the mothers were taking their daughters out and saying, get out there and get going. 80, 85, 90% of all the girls over 13 years old in Ahuantefillo were prostitutes, simply because they couldn't stay alive otherwise. And all the little boys from 4 or 5 years old, and some of the 4 to 6 or 7 year olds were the best at thievery and robbery that also contributed to their living. Now this is really hardcore poverty that I'm talking about. It's into situations like that that Mireya Baltadano goes with other Christian university students to train secretaries. Well, I said, what do you do? You know, short end type. Oh, we haven't even got that yet. What we teach first is how you bathe. Because there's no way to get a job if you don't know how to bathe. You got to learn how to, she teaches them how to fix their hair, how to make clothes, how to brush their teeth, all, and how to speak in decent language and leave out the equivalent of the four-letter words, so that they can be respectable secretaries and be hireable. And somewhere along the line, she'll get at the final little detail, which isn't all that hard, and that is to teach them how to type and take shorthand. And I would never in my life have the patience to spend all that time and year after year going down the barrio in the hopes that you can see a few people who can escape it and get out. But she wouldn't get caught under any circumstances walking into a church on Sunday morning. And she says that if there was any good that could come of it, she would pick up a gun and join in the fighting, if there was to be fighting. But she said in Costa Rica, there's no chance that it could ever succeed. So none of us are that foolish. And there is no armed revolution coming up. So they're doing it the slow and patient and hard way. They regard themselves as communists, kind of Castro-style communists. And I guess I have to say, because I mean it with all my heart, that if my home was in Costa Rica, I would join her and those students, because I would know no other way to accomplish the goals. The few of them have died in my arms. A few kids have died that they're stupid. They die of little things that they don't have to die from. Silly things, embarrassing things like worms in your belly. And it takes about 50 cents worth of something to get them out of there, you know, at least for the time being. It doesn't take very much to teach people how to dig pit latrines. And some of us have spent a few months doing that, just teaching them how to dig a hole and make a little, and also make a little plaster form for a little concrete top for the pit latrine, to get away from some of the problems of the other kind of sanitation or the absence of it. Now, let me just jump for a moment and I back off here. In Tanzania, a hospital involved in a program, just a demonstration thing. We didn't have much money to work with, but the 51% of all children died before they were 5 in an area near Moshi, Tanzania, some of you know the area, on the slopes kind of Mount Kilimanjaro. Not a bad area as Tanzanian areas go, but 51% of all kids died. They died of mostly things that were related to malnutrition, died of measles, but you don't die of measles if you're healthy, usually don't. But if you're already suffering from marasmus, kwashiorkor, severe nutritional problems, and if you're a little child, there isn't much chance you can survive even things that are rather minor diseases otherwise. And in a 5-year demonstration program, and working from a baseline that some very systematic German gal helped work out, we found that we could cut the death rate, the mortality rate, among children under 5 from 51, a little over 51%, to just under 26%. That's just cutting it in half. And to save those lives that were represented by that, we saw 10,000 kids a month for a period of 5, the same 10,000, except for the new births that came along, for that 5 years. The lives that were saved cost $16 to save. And now the Tanzanian government has picked up that program, runs it completely, and is starting 50 centers like the little one that we use for demonstration. I don't know if that represents hope for the poor, but I suppose that it does in some very small way. A little goes a long way if we're humble enough to let them do it, to let them do it. For instance, as part of that program, we have a nutritional rehabilitation unit where they take little red-haired Tanzanian babies. Red hair is a good signal there, because if there isn't enough protein going into the brain, there isn't enough going into the hair even, it turns red. And it flags right away that there's something wrong. And what it means is that there isn't enough protein going into that kid in the first months of his life to make it possible for his brain to develop normally. You don't have very long to have a normal brain develop inside of you. And we didn't want to parade him through some large, great, shining hospital, because you could only begin to scratch the surface. We didn't want any of these wards that I'd seen too many times, 50, 100 kids with plaster casts on their head and scalpings sticking through the scalping, feeding them through the scalp. And then by the miracle of modern medicine, you know, being able to save their lives. So instead of that, we did a little differently. I showed them what the good vegetables were, high protein. We take the mother of the little red-haired child down to the nutritional rehabilitation unit, show her the garden, give her a little plot to get started on that's already planted, and then show her how to pick them just enough for herself and for the baby for that day at maximum nutritional stage in the growth of the plant, cook it in a, prepare it in a way that the baby can ingest it, and then after 30 or 40 days or so, the mother can look at her little baby and say, I cured my baby. And then she can go back, or at least we thought she could go back to the village and say to the next, to the mother of the next little red-haired baby, hey, I'll show you what we do. You plant these, I did it, now you can do it too. It didn't work. And it didn't work because the impoverished are not respected in Tanzania any more than they are in Chicago or Seattle. You don't go to them for advice. You don't listen to the voice of the poor. But fortunately, the church was present, so we went to the churches and said, hey, can you give us some influential women from the village to go along with the mother of the Kwashiorkor child? And when that churchwoman came back, coming from a cut up the economic ladder, the poor people would listen to her. They wouldn't listen to another poor person. But, well, for whatever it's worth. Little bits of hope, I suppose, that I happen to have had walked by and have seen. But there's so precious little of it. There are 5 million kids in Central America and Northern South America. 5 million kids who don't have any kind of a home whatsoever and run around like a bunch of little pack rats at night. 5 million of them. You ought to see them. Well, I don't know where you want to go with this. All I'm doing is expressing some agony, I guess.
There's another ray of hope in Quito, Ecuador, that that I visited when I was there, and also the Hoffmans. Did you meet them, Fritz? Had worked the Hoffmans. Paul, I think it was Hoffman.
No,
his wife. There's a Jesuit priest in Quito. His name is John Halligan. He's been there about a dozen years, a little bit more than that now. But he has started a working boys school. And he takes the kids off the streets from ages 4 through 17 that he had 2 years ago when I was there. They start the day with a hot shower and a hot meal. They have classes in the morning, and then they go out on the street selling newspapers, lottery tickets, shining shoes, or whatever their trade is. And once they commit themselves to go through this working boys school, they must get the equivalent of a grade school, an elementary education, say an equivalent of $400, and learn a trade. And he has done a marvelous a thing in the barrio area of Quito, Ecuador. And it the government sort of leaves him alone. They feel that he's a communist, but he's doing the thing that they don't want to do, so he hasn't really been bothered. He comes up to the States periodically for fundraising. So it was quite a large structure that he's gotten funds for to build the school.
You spent most of your time in Peru, didn't
yes.
you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We were Pastor Quito. Mm-hmm. In Peru, I didn't really confront any of the rays of hope kind of thing, but some of the tragedies that we learned of firsthand were when the military governments like to express their power. So anytime there's a new military government, then they do away with the old and they have to start over new. So some of the latter military governments have been nationalizing everything and giving everything back to the peasants. And in doing so, they haven't trained the peasants what to do. So in this one case of a family who were educated in the children were educated in the United States, they knew a little bit about experimental farming and whatever. They were developing a strain of an alpaca herd that would be pure white. They had a very rich sugar plantation down into the jungle. So the time of the nationalization, the father came home from his travels and his family were being held at gunpoint, and they had 12 hours to pack out what they could on their backs. They could take no animals, no vehicles, or anything, and leave. And then the land was given to the peasants. Well, the peasants didn't know how to operate the farm. They knew nothing about the mechanics of farm management. So in a couple of years' time, the production of the farm was down to a third of what it had been before. And they didn't know what the breeding of the experimental program with the alpaca were, so they were hungry and ate the alpaca. Mm-hmm. And it's a tragedy. The government meant good in turning the land back to the peasants, but did not give them the opportunity to know what to do with what they were being given. Another tragedy of the nationalization of Peru, which doesn't exactly hit the poor people, but it helps the rich become richer. Peru in Lima, they had one of the finest art institutes of the world, with masters of the arts. So they decided, well, we have to nationalize and have a museum, an art institute of Peruvian works of art, which I think is just fine, but not take away what's already there. So they took all these Monets and Picassos and Renoirs and gave them to those that were already rich. And this one home that a fellow we met was staying, he went to was given the name of this person. He had been the Minister of Education. I went to take a rest in the bedroom, and he said he couldn't go to sleep because he felt like he was in a museum. So there in Miraflores, which is a suburb of Lima, is this extremely another art institute, which is somebody's home, and no one sees it except the people that live there and the guests that come to his home. And another suburb of Lima, which is a barrio, it is, the police do not go, even the military police do not go into it. It is so controlled and so dangerous. One time there was some reason that they did go into it, And before you could blink an eye, all the vehicles had been confiscated by the people of this barrio. And interestingly enough, they call this barrio Chicago. But I think in my traveling in South America, I had to really, one of the hardest things was to adjust to the viewing the poverty.
Tim.
I guess we still want to talk about the question, is there hope for the poor? That's what I let me try to address just to that for a couple of seconds. I think we ask the question wrongly if we put it in terms of what can we do. I don't think there's very much that we can do. I think we're locked into a situation where we're a part of the 10 or 12% of the more affluent part of the world. And a couple of decades of development, private and government to government, have made the situation worse, not better. That more profits have flowed this way than gone into easing the gap. 50% of the world's population lives on less than $100 a year. Now, there are different qualities of life. An Indian who lives on $15 a year, you know, is... But I don't think there's much that we can do. Everybody says, what can we do? There isn't much. Now, ask, where have things begun to change? And there are a few places in this world, and there are some very specific reasons why they have begun to change. And in these situations, there may be some clues. Not absolute clues, because it's too variated a place, this rich, poor world. Third world isn't one place, it's all kinds of places. Indonesia has begun to change. And this is because there is a strong, unified government, basically responsive to the people, that has functioned with a cultural unity and one language, and through the thick and the thin of the Sukarno era and beyond, here is a society that has basically tried to work from the grassroots up through what we would call forms of parliamentary democracy. There aren't many places like this. Indonesia is probably the only place in Asia. Pakistan, Sri Lanka, India, Bangladesh are probably the biggest examples of the failure of development decade as some of the Latin American countries. But where have things changed? There are fundamentally two places, and maybe third, if you count Tanzania in Africa, where a more radical kind of experiment is going on in Africa. In Latin America, we have the example of Cuba. Prior to that, or at least predating that, in Asia, we have the example of China. Now, China and India, or the Indian subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and what is now Bangladesh, were in 1950 were probably of equal size in population, China having a bit of a bulge. I think it's also well to remember that 200 years ago, a British soldier that went out to India, or to any place else in Asia, went from a village in England, or a rural area in England, or wherever, to a country in Asia where the economic level was almost exactly the same. Where it was a non-cash economy by and large. Our forefathers, even in this country, we know something about this. What was the difference? I think we were saying it. The Industrial Revolution and the consequent, the almost inevitable and drive for raw materials and markets and all of the rest. So you've got to analyze what's going wrong. You've got to get at the root of the problem. Now, there are only two societies that seem to have come at it in a mass kind of way. Here, there is real hope, where the development ideology with which we are generally engaged in, there is very little hope, because the basic problem is not the poor world, but the rich world. The basic problem is with us, and we do not have the political conditions that can really make change. We cannot have a Congress, for example, that will do the kind of tough tariffs and the tough energy laws. We are 40% dependent on Arab oil right now. And we're competing for India with it, which spends 90% of all of its foreign exchange just to get a little bit of fertilizer. All right, now what did China do? It cut itself off. Why? Because for 150 years or so, it had been rather easily divided up among five or six Western powers, including the United States, with little islands of economic influence. A terrible humiliation and terrible economic cost. It was under the complete domination, political and economic, of the countries that chose so to use it. You've all heard of the Opium War. We think, Opium War. We fought that to stop China from selling opium. We did nothing of the sort. Well, it was a British war. We didn't have anything to do with it. We're Americans. British raised opium in Assam, not far from where Frank worked in Nepal for all those years. And they shipped the opium to China, where they sold it return for sale, which went to England, which bought manufactured goods that went back to India that were built with raw materials that came out of India. And the Opium War was fought to keep that three-corner trade going. What did China do after 1949? It totally cut itself off from the West. Why? To build itself on the inside. It was big enough to do it. So India and China are the two things you've got to look at in Asia. I used to say to myself that given 150 years of peace, the kind of humanistic way that India blunders on, that's really going to be determinative in the future, because it's a quality of human life that I think, from what we can tell, is there in China. But there's one place where, now, I'm not saying everything's perfect in China. Nobody's naive enough to say that. Nobody's saying there's not repression. I'm saying there is medical care at the village level. Children are not dying from worms and dysentery anymore. They are not dying from the lack of latrines. People are not starving for lack of employment. This is not true in India. The gap has gotten wider, not narrower. And the other experiment is Castro's Cuba, where again, the country has gone from 3% literacy to 99% literacy. More people read and write in Cuba now than in the United States. Second only to Japan in terms of literacy. So you've got to ask now, is there hope? Well, there isn't much hope. If the development model that we're now following is where the development model, by the way, during the decade of 1960 to 1970, had the ideal that each developed country would give 1% of its gross national product. You must remember that I think something over 50% of our gross national product is spent on military. Maybe 5% of our gross national product is spent on some form of local government. I don't know what the figures are. It isn't much. 1% for foreign aid. No country reached it. The United States is 14th in the list of the countries that give. France came the closest because they've got all these special arrangements that with Francophone Africa and Madagascar. England is out of us, Denmark is way out of us, Sweden is way out of us in terms of gross national product. We're 14th on the list. We've fallen from a high point of 0.6% to less than 0.2%. But even if we gave 2%, the effect has been in Latin America, for every $3 that has gone in there, or $4, of military aid or direct government aid or capital investment, private capital investment, for every $1 that's gone in there, $4 has flowed back this way. India is smart enough not to let this happen. They don't let this happen. They control their investments. They've been way, way ahead of the rest of the world on this, the rest of the poor world. They've shaken off some of this thing of direct exploitation, but their other bankers. No, the only thing that's going to give hope to the poor, and it's nothing we can do. We can't do it. We're not going to be the ones that can do it because it's politically impossible. Economically impossible. I'm not saying impossible. All things are possible.
Can we stand in the way of them doing their own development, though?
No,
is there a danger? Is there a danger?
For us, and it's going to be done for our liberation. Mm-hmm. See, we can't even do it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can model certain types of things, as Holden did, to some extent. But so good news for us. We really ought to ask, is there good news for us? Mm-hmm. And I think the thing is, the good news for us is that without idealizing and romanticizing and without knowing that there, you know, there is as much outright corruption and affluence and misuse of it within Asia, Africa, and Latin America as within our own society. I mean, just because you're poor doesn't mean you're a saint, although the Bible seems to think so. The poor and saint are very much the same in Aramaic. I'm really serious about this. Is there good news for us? And the good news is that maybe somebody else besides us will get at this way of solving the gap between the rich world and the poor world, which I don't think there's any model or any possibility now that we are erecting. Some of you have read Denis Boulay and some of the things that he's written. You've got to read his Introduction to the Development Debate to find out the difference between developmentism as an ideology which has failed, and a form then of coming at this that makes justice much more the central question. You all know Paulo Freire's writings, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Paulo Freire says it's not the rich that are going to do it, the poor, it's the poor themselves. Now, poor won't listen to poor, but what's conscientizing all about? And it's a way of saying that each person has a critical vocation, no matter how unschooled and illiterate, can understand his environment and change it. That's pretty dynamic stuff, you see. I once asked Paulo Freire, what really drives you? He said, there's just one word. And I think you'd all be surprised at this word. This man who's sort of the prophet now of the conscientizing movement, the prophet of the poor, the man who's done more to influence the way in which we look at development and education. You know what that one word was? Would you be interested? Mm-hmm. He said, Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. He says, I read the Gospels through every month, he says. He says, I've never found anything reactionary about Jesus yet. I read the whole Bible. He says, oh, of course, I'm just a layman. I'm not a theologian. He would say the same thing. There he was. And that's where his dynamic comes from. And so if you say, is there hope? You know, I say, let's look beyond ourselves. Let's see what's going on in the world. Everything doesn't have to begin and end in the United States. Everything doesn't have to begin and end in America. And, you know, we could tell a thousand things that are happening. A lot of bad things that are happening, too. We still have a mission. There's still a place for cross-cultural mission. I'm not saying there isn't. I guess, Frank, you'd agree with me on that. But I'm really serious about this. But I think that the question boils down, is there hope to the ready?
Good.
I want to tell you just one more thing, because I'm sorry, I'm going too long. But in this conversation, I had two colleagues. One was a black South African. I had many colleagues, but at my last job, I had two of my colleagues. One was a black South African, one was a Taiwanese. Both were more or less in exile. Taiwanese from Chiang Kai-shek's Formosa. He was struggling for Taiwanese civil rights. Desmond Tutu, black South African. You know the situation. Desmond went back as the first dean of the Anglican Cathedral in Johannesburg. Called back. First black dean, yeah, where French Bayata was banned from that point. You see, he was banned. And when he left, you were there, Shoki took his hand, Shoki Ko, the Taiwanese, and said to Desmond, almost with tears in his eyes, he said, I know you're going back into a difficult situation, but for you there is hope because things will change, and you're able to start making your own change. He says, for me, there won't be any change. Either China wants us or the United States wants us to be with the national scale. For me, there's no hope for God. He says, but now there was an example to me of the way in which I think change is going to be. Frank knows Northeast India, where there's a vigorous Christian movement that has almost, for all of this year, has almost totally been without missionaries. They closed down a residential seminary and sent the crops out into 40 different centers out in the villages. And they said, we've just got to get at white people. I did this without Ross Ginsburg and the extension program of Latin America, without its propagator Ralph Winter. They did it. You know, they're just things that are happening. And I'm really serious when I say, is there hope for today? Is there hope for you in that?
Yeah. And if you don't give them respect, honest respect, then I think this is what separates brothers and sisters, no matter what your economic or your class or your race. And this is what has divided our world and has, at least to me, brought about so many problems. The lack of just simple caring and respect for people.
I used to work for that organization that's now defunct, the American Freedom from Hunger Foundation. As an organizer in the Midwest, in North Dakota and Minnesota. And we raised money by mostly high school and college kids who went on these things called Walks for Development, and then the money was raised and split up between development projects overseas and development projects in the United States. And part of our job as organizers was to find projects in local areas where people raise money to give to their, you know, people in their local areas. And I came to realize that what we can do is where can give. We want to do something. Certainly, there's no place in America, anywhere, that within a 5-mile radius of where you live, lacks situations in which there are poor and desperate and needy people. And very few places in America lack the leadership of people who are trying to do the thing. But, so, you know, it just means that you give them your money, you give them your time, and you read a word. It's hard for me now because I did a lot of that, but I gave it all back up, went to school, and kind of faded out of, you know, doing that sort of thing. We live in a country where 20%, you know, almost 20% of the population lives below the what is called the established poverty line, that the government set. And a lot of people with malnutrition, you know, this illiteracy is a problem in our country, that sort of thing. And it's deep. It's not at all the other thing.
I think certainly I'd like just to make a comment about what you said, Jim. I would agree with you that to change basically the economy and the political and the social structure of a country like India and some of the other countries of the Indian subcontinent is beyond us. We're not going to do that. But there is the opportunity still in certain parts of the world for cross-cultural mission if we as missionaries are willing to do the things that you were speaking about, Dr. Norstedt, when you spoke about radical community health programs that reach out into village levels in Tanzania or Latin America. The United Mission to Nepal is engaged in that kind of mission. We've discovered that mission is not simply preaching, but it's ministering to the whole man. It means launching community health programs wherever there are opportunities, and this means in a good part of that mountain kingdom of some 12 millions of people, the same sort of things, to teach basic nutrition and bringing mothers in with malnourished children, to teach them how to cook the right sort of food and use food which is available to them, to teach village people how to use the manure off their from their water buffalo as the basic generating power for methane gas, so they can begin to use that as well as using it as fertilizer. Teaching people how to do simple things that Schumacher suggests in Small is Beautiful. Those opportunities are still available, and there are places in the world where there are still possibilities and openings for us to do that sort of thing. The sort of thing that Mother Teresa has done on the streets of Calcutta now has spread around the world, and she even has a chapter in Los Angeles. I don't know if she has one in Seattle or not, but these are some things that can be done to help the poorest of the poor. We were astounded when we visited Mother Teresa's work in Calcutta to see young people who had been a part of the so-called hippie movement. I realize you didn't like the term hippie. I don't like it either. World travelers, what we call them in Nepal, to avoid the use of that term. But here were young Australians and Swedes and Canadians who came and said, I'll give 6 months or I'll give a year of my time to help the poorest of the poor with you, if you, Mother Teresa, can put me to work. There are young people who will respond to the opportunity for that kind of service, to get down and work with the very poorest of the poor, because they've seen somebody else give them a model of what it means to serve as a Christian, not just to preach. And I think we should take those opportunities, Jim, even
I do too.
Yeah.
But what we're in on, you see, is what the overblown language in today's debate is called the micro versus the macro approach.
Right.
I think both are necessary. Micro approach says, dig in where you are and do what you can.
Right.
Our missions and our aid programs have been up to our eyeballs in models of things. Mm. Many of them very good. Many of them have been able to reproduce themselves. The failure of some of this has been that these have been micro approaches, small approaches. But there's still a place for macro change if you are going to affect it at all. Because in Calcutta is a city of 10 million, which will be 19 million in 10 more years. It's a city with over half the population, less than adequately housed and fed. And Mother Teresa is doing magnificent work. And I think it should be pointed out that the bulk of her workers are committed Indian sisters who have been a part of her order for years and years and years on end. And when you visit Mother Teresa, this is what you see from me that show. It's significant to have other people coming. But I really think we as Christians, each individual is important. A micro approach is not without significance. We're called to that. But I think we dare not lose sight of the fact that we're also dealing with some macro things here. Some of us are ALC, I don't know how many. In the city of Detroit, do you know what the Lutheran population was 10 years ago? 20,000 people. Do you know what it is today? 8,000. Because there are fewer people there? No, we don't know how to do ministry there. What we ought to do is learn from the black community how to do ministry. We ought to have an ecumenical approach to ministry and forget about it. We don't know how to do ministry in these areas. We absolutely don't. When we work overseas, we say, well, we develop indigenous ministries and we work contextually. We don't do that in this country. This is another example, I'm saying, of learning from somebody else about how to do things.
I suspect the future of the church is going to be very much preoccupied with the three words of salt and light and leaven. And that calls for a great deal of humility, as over against almost any other approach.
I want to raise a question.
I must be excused. Go ahead.
The macro approach in the United States, it seems to me, and this is, it's ideal just to raise it, but I think we got to address the macro question dealing with our own selves, is dealing with our own government. And such things like Rudy mentioned this morning, our own president having a hard time even getting the gas to be raised 5 cents to start balancing the world fuel situation, which seems to me this morning, up until hearing him this morning, I was sort of sitting on the fence as well about an opinion about that particular tiddly effort to change things and to try to encourage not just him, but encourage some courage of leadership within our own selves in this area. And I think here is another place, if we address the power of the world, and one of the greatest powers of the world, we have a congressman with us right here at this moment, you know, as a symbol and a living reality of that particular chance we have possibly to touch base with decision making, knowing how intensely difficult is the question, yet at the same time knowing that, you know, we are a sleeping giant, like you're saying. We don't know how to work together. And there is where maybe the heart of the crux of the matter really lies.
That is my question while I go, Ted, in a way. Can we stand in the way of other countries by getting very uptight about, oh, they're going communist or something, and by our policy actually making it harder for them to develop in the way that might be best for them? And that was the question of citizenship, which I think you're addressing. It's a difficult issue, but it's one that there is the meeting of staff, and I think this discussion has just begun. But if we've been sensitive to the power of the Spirit is working in new ways and different ways, that's what it's all about. Yes.